Okay, hello everybody. It is nice to see you all back here again. Even as in the midst of all the craziness in the world, it's good to have some regular practice and a chance to see all your faces. So we'll learn a little bit of Torah. I want to say that Fred's background is particularly helpful for today, as we're going to spend some time talking about blessings and curses on mountains. So thank you for that image.
That's Midbar Tzin.
It really?
Yeah, I took the picture from Ben Gurion's house a few years ago, and it's one of the few pictures I took that I really love. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for that scenery.
Sure, gladly.
Okay, so we're going to pick up where we are in Mishnah Sota. We are in chapter 7 here. Going through the lists of the things that can be said in any language and the things that need to be said in Hebrew. We mentioned briefly that first list in Mishnah Aleph, it's not entirely clear just based on the language of the Mishnah itself, whether ne'amarin, these are said, means they may be said in any language, or really they should be said in the language that a person understands. That was an ambiguity there. And then on the next list, it seems that the point is these things should be said in Hebrew. Now, as we're going to go on here to Mishnah Gimel, we will see that the Mishnah goes to great lengths to prove that the things that need to be said in Hebrew need to be said in Hebrew. While it doesn't spend time here proving that the things that may be said in any language may be said in any language, which makes it feel like the intuition or kind of your status quo would actually be to say things in the colloquial language that people understand, and it requires additional proof to go in the direction of requiring that something be recited in Hebrew. So I just want to say that as a macro comment before we delve into the specifics of what is recited in Hebrew. Okay, here we are, Mishnah Gimel. Mikra Vikurim Ketzad. So how is it that the declaration for bringing the first fruits must be in Hebrew? So Ketzad here is introducing the proof to know that it's in Hebrew. The word Ketzad can mean a lot of things. We'll see later on that Ketzad can mean, well, how is this ritual done in a much fuller and comprehensive way? Here, the question is just, how is it that we know that the recitation for bringing the first fruits in Deuteronomy chapter 26. Again, that's the piece, my father was a wandering Aramean, Arami Oved Avi. How do we know that that needs to be recited in Hebrew? So we're gonna go through some Gezerah Shava type leaps. So finding a similar word in different psukim to teach that a similar law should apply to two cases. So in chapter 26, for bringing the first fruits, the verse says, Va'anita va'amarta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. It says, you shall answer or respond, or maybe proclaim would be a good way to translate this here, and say before Hashem, your God. So we have that verb, va'anita. Ulahalan hu omer ve'anu halevi'im ve'amru. And later on in the book of Deuteronomy, it says, the Levites shall answer and say. Okay, so in case we weren't all sure, based on those three words, what is happening in chapter 27 in Deuteronomy, we're going to scroll down here. This is the chapter that speaks about the blessings and the curses when the people enter the land. We will look at this more later. But we have here the word ve'anu. So this is kind of midway through the chapter. Right over here, I'm highlighting it, and I have it in the bold. Ve'anu ha-levi'im ve'amru el kol ish Yisrael kol ram. So the Levites shall proclaim in a loud voice to all the people of Israel. So that verb appears in both places. Anu. Well, that's great, but actually it hasn't really taught us anything yet. We'll see how the end of this Mishnah goes and realize that we don't have all the information we need. The Mishnah concludes, Ma aniyah ha'amura lahalan bilashon hakodesh, afkan bilashon hakodesh, just like that root, verb, aniya, to answer or respond or proclaim, over there by the blessings and the curses on the mountains was done in the holy tongue, Lashon HaKodesh. So too here, for bringing the first fruits, it should be done in the holy tongue, the Lashon Kodesh. Okay, any questions?
Can you go over the logic again?
Yes, the logic is based on, I don't know if logic is quite the right word for it. It's the logic by similarity reasoning. So we have this verb, va'anita, you shall proclaim for bringing the first fruits, right, answer. We have the same verb used when the Levites are introducing the blesses and curses on Har Gerizim and Har Eval, on those mountains, when they enter the land, also has that word answer. Since the Levites are speaking in Hebrew, so too when you bring your first fruits, you do it in Hebrew because we have that same verb that is used.
How do we know they're speaking in Hebrew?
Well, great. So yes, so somebody's given us our transitive property, A equals B, B equals C, A equals C. And yes, the point is, okay, I can buy that, but how have you proven to me that the Levites are speaking in Hebrew? That work has actually not yet been done. So that work is not done in the Mishnah, but there are other sources to look at that will point us in the right direction. So we're gonna scroll down here to a verse that may look familiar after the holiday of Shavuot. Make it nice and big here. At the scene of Sinai, this is Exodus, chapter 19, verse 19. It says, "Vayhi kol ha-shofar holech v'chazik me'od, Moshe yedaber v'ha-Elohim ya'anenu b'kol." There was the blare of the shofar, grew louder and louder. Moses spoke at Sinai. God answered in thunder. Okay, now it's kind of fun to use this proof text. I mean, this is the introduction to the Ten Commandments, though it seems like part of the point here might actually be about cacophonous sound, more so than specific words and language, but essentially based on this word, ya'anenu, here we see that the verb that's used for revelation, meaning God speaking to the people, right? This is where we assume when God is speaking, of course, God speaks Lashon Kodesh, kind of by what's the word I'm looking for? Inevitably, right? The language that the divine is using is going to be the divine language. So that sacred speech at Sinai must have been in Hebrew. We see that it's introduced with this word, ya'anenu. And so anytime we find that verb, ya'anenu, answer, we know that it is in Hebrew. So that we've now introduced our third verse here that can leapfrog us to the case of the Levites and then back to Bikurim. Now it's a little bit more complex than that when this proof is fully made, because it seems like if that was really the point, we could have just, or maybe should have even, gone from our case of first fruits in Deuteronomy and jumped to Sinai, that word ya'anenu, and God answered him. So it seems like it's actually a little bit more complex. The way we get from Sinai to the Levites is actually also based on the word kol, voice, a loud voice. So we have that word kol, a loud voice, for the blessings and curses, and we have the word kol, right? God would answer with a voice, though interestingly, the translation that's probably the more straightforward translation here is thunder. So again, it's kind of ironic to go from this cacophonous, thunderous sound to the specifics of language and Hebrew. But that actually seems to be a linchpin here in the argument that we have this additional word, kol. Kol is really what proves to us that also at on the mountains, the blessings and curses were Hebrew. And then, based on the verb to answer, proclaim, ba'anu, we can get to Bikurim, the first fruits, that has the word va'anita, you shall answer, but does not have the word kol, voice. Okay, Let's pause there for any questions, reactions.
We're trying to prove or demonstrate that these certain prayers should be spoken in Hebrew, but not other prayers. So I'm guessing the other prayers don't have this kind of proof. Is that what we're saying?
That's right. So the idea would be that those other passages aren't introduced with the word, with that verb, ve'anu, to answer.
Yeah.
That's far.
Exactly is the reference to Sinai in the Mishnah.
It's not. It is not in the Mishnah. You have to go to other sources to find it, namely the Talmud. So the Talmud here on the Mishnah brings that proof text from the word kol. Now, I suppose if you don't want to go that full route, you could say that the Mishnah isn't based on that, and the Mishnah just assumes that the Levim and the blessings and curses were in Hebrew and didn't prove it. It would just be a little bit dissatisfying. It's also interesting to think about, meaning if the Mishnah isn't actually premised on the use of that word kol and going to the moment and really the only moment of divine speech, a divine speech act, to derive other cases of speech acts that would be done in Hebrew. You could say that maybe the assumption in the Mishnah is that any formal speech given by the Levi'im to all of the people would also have to be in Hebrew. That's just an assumption. That's the only other very public speech act in these cases, right? Almost all of our other cases are one individual speaking or personal. So I guess the reason I'm saying that is because there's kind of debates about how to relate to this sort of reasoning in Talmud and Mishnah, and whether it's just totally technical, right? Just finding these words and these links and that's it, or whether there's something larger and intertextual by bringing together these different sources. And I would say that the kind of critical substantive question on the table is, do we derive, what's kind of the or moment? What is that original moment of speech in Hebrew that's going to be the source for all other rituals that need to be in Hebrew? Is it, right, God's voice at Sinai? That, like I said, it must be in the divine language if it's the divine speaking. Or is it that sort of full public Israel altogether and what they are saying for the blessings and curses? Okay, and for the Talmud, it goes from Sinai to the Levites and then beyond. So we'll look at the next piece here. Yeah, Noah.
I have a thought that might help me understand that if we think about the Shoresh as being representative of an entire semantic boundary, perhaps that lends to me why this is answer doesn't say it to me, but response says it to me. It doesn't convey the complexity of meaning that I would like to see, and that's because I'm reading the English. Anyway, just wanted to add.
Yeah, great. So definitely we might want to be looking for a range of translations for anu. Yeah. Maybe proclaim is better, or respond. Yeah. But I think, right, a lot of what we're trying to do is unpack the resonance of what this root means. And I think, right, part of the question, which we might not even think about because we sort of take it for granted, is what is the significance or meaning of saying something in Hebrew? And maybe that's obvious to some of us. I hope that was maybe disrupted a little bit based on that first Mishnah and the list in the first Mishnah that includes prayer and includes Shema as things that can be recited in any language. And maybe that disrupts us enough to kind of want to think twice about what we are trying to accomplish when we say something in Lashon Kodesh. And I should add, even saying Hebrew isn't a helpful translation here either, right? It's not about Hebrew in a specific language. It's specifically Lashon Kodesh, right? What are we trying to do when we use divine language? And that's where I think bringing in this piece from the Talmud that brings all of this back to Sinai is actually, right, if we're trying to kind of put that divine speech and that revelatory moment that, again, in the plain text might have been more cacophonous than any kind of discrete language is, if we're trying to somehow access that through Lashon Kodesh in general, it's an interesting trajectory and provocative trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, so we're gonna move on to the next Mishnah. Bear with my scrolling down. I sometimes feel like I'm on a roller coaster when someone else is on screen share and then they just scroll down. Hold on to your seatbelts. Okay, but here is our next Mishnah. So chapter 7, Mishnah 4. Chalitza, ketzad. How do we know that chalitza, right, that process that ends the levirate relationship, has to be said in Hebrew? Okay, so this is when the brother's widow goes up to him, the levir, right, the brother-in-law, in the presence of the elders, pulls the sandal off his foot, spits in his face, and makes this declaration. Ve'anta ve'amra, I bolded that in the Hebrew. She shall respond or proclaim and say the following: Kacha ye'ase la'ish asher lo yivne et beit achiv. Thus shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house, who will not marry the sister-in-law. So, right, we have here again that verb, ve'anta ve'amra, she shall proclaim and say. And, right, the Mishnah says, ulahalan hu omer ve'anu halivim ve'amru. And there, again, by the blessings and curses on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, it says that the Levites shall respond or answer and say, use of that same root is going to lead to the same conclusion. Ma aniyaha amura lahalan bilashon hakodesh af kan bilashon hakodesh. So just like that root for answer over there for the blessings and curses is in the holy tongue, so too the declaration here for the ending the levir process is in the holy tongue. Okay, so in some ways, not surprising, same formula as before. In other ways, I think it's very interesting, right? We might understand the bringing of the first fruits as a ritual kind of prayerful moment. This seems like it's a little bit more in the realm of civil law. Though it's also interesting, the language of this declaration, thus shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house, and spitting in the shoe, has curse-like resonances. So if we think of the paradigm here as the blessings and curses, maybe that's also a substantive piece of this. But in any case, that's the formal mechanism is the same as before. But then we have a different position at the end of this Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ve'anta ve'amra kacha, ad she'tomar balashon hazeh. So Rabbi Yehuda says it's not based on the word, that verb to respond or proclaim being used here as well. Rather, it's based on this word, kacha, thus. Rabbi Yehuda says, thus she shall answer and say, thus she must say it in this language. So this is sort of a pre-Masoretic moment in the Mishnah, right? How to parse this verse. Where do you put the comma? Is it, she shall respond and say, colon, thus shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house? Or the kind of playful reading here, although it doesn't quite work with the plain text, would be to put the colon one word later. She shall proclaim and say, thus, colon, shall be done to the man who won't build up his brother's house. So it's more of a play than a straightforward meaning, but that is the creative reading of Rabbi Yehuda. Which interestingly seems to suggest that that verb on its own, ana, isn't enough to require something to be in Lashon Kodesh. And that might bring us to ask what Rabbi Yehuda thinks about the previous case, because it does not have the word kacha, thus.
I think Rabbi Yehuda is more like kacha. Yeah, that makes much more sense to me.
Great. Yeah, so that's a little bit more of a substantive proof rather than the Gezeirah Shavah just picking up similarities in verbs across different verses. So I can see how it's more logical and less formulaic. Any other questions on this piece? Chalitza.
Has anyone looked up, are there other uses of the word that don't fit this pattern?
Okay, you're wondering if this is comprehensive. Okay, that's a good question, but I'm gonna wait to answer that question until we continue with the Mishnah's presentation of its full set. But yeah, that is an excellent question to be asking here and gets to the whole point of how do these proof texts and Midrash work? Is it like really this is learned out from these technical uses of the same verb and so it should be a systematic rule that applies to everything? Or is it that we sort of have the tradition that this is in Hebrew and then these linguistic clues come as sort of a later hook, in which case it might not need to be fully comprehensive.
It sounds more the latter.
Yeah, so we'll see. Or I can give that to you for homework before we finish this chapter. You can see if you find any that would defy this line of reasoning. Okay. Well, in our next 6 minutes, I think we can do a bit of the next Mishnah, which is quite long, but I think it won't be bad to give it a little bit of a start because it is quite long. And you know, I think maybe what we'll do is we'll introduce what we need to look at for this next Mishnah by going back to the biblical text. Okay, because we're going to get a different kind of ketzad here. So the next Mishnah is going to talk about the blessings and the curses and that whole process. So it's going to be worthwhile for us to review the biblical text that is actually fairly lengthy around this ritual process when they enter the land of Israel. Okay, so here we are, Deuteronomy chapter 27. Moshe and the elders of Israel charge the people, saying, "Observe all the instruction that I enjoin upon you this day. As soon as you have crossed the Jordan into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall set up large stones, coat them with plaster. Inscribe upon them all the words of this teaching. When you cross over to enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. Upon crossing the Jordan, you shall set up these stones about which I charge you this day on Mount Ebal and coat them with plaster." So a bit repetitive. You can understand why we might need the Mishnah to clarify all the steps here in order. And then it goes on. "There too, you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. Do not wield an iron tool over them." We see this also in Exodus chapter 20, the prohibition on using metal for the altar. Okay, "You must build the altar of the Lord your God of unhewn stones. You shall offer on it burnt offerings to the Lord your God. You shall sacrifice there offerings of well-being, eat them, rejoicing before the Lord your God. And on those stones you shall inscribe every word of this teaching most distinctly. Moses and the Levitical priest spoke to all of Israel, saying, 'Silence, hear, O Israel, today you have become the people of the Lord your God. Heed the Lord your God, observe his commandments and his laws, which I enjoin upon you this day.' Thereupon Moshe charged the people, saying, 'After you have crossed the Jordan, the following shall stand on Mount Gerizim when the blessing for the people is spoken: Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Yosef, and Binyamin. And for the curse, the following shall stand on Mount Ebal: Reuven, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali.'" Then our verse: "The Levites shall then proclaim in a loud voice to all the people of Israel," and I just gave you one curse, but you can finish the rest of chapter 27 to remind yourself of the rest of them if you'd like. Quote, "Cursed be anyone who makes a sculptured or molten image abhorred by the Lord, a craftsman handiwork, and sets it up in secret," and all the people shall respond, "Amen." So worthwhile for us to review that whole chapter. You see that there's two things that are combined here. There's putting the words of the teaching, Kol HaMitzvah, sounds quite comprehensive, in plastered on large stones, and then offering sacrifices, and then the blessings and the curses. This is a fun passage for a biblical critic to look at in terms of the repetitive nature and some of the tense changes. But we'll see how the Mishnah tries to go from this fairly lengthy description and somewhat confusing description in terms of the repetitiveness into an extremely clear ritual process. So that is where we will pick up tomorrow. It's an example, I will say as my last thing, since I have to mention this book every time we learn this Masechet, this tractate. It's an example of another extended passage about a ritual, just like Sota is an extended passage about a ritual. So even though technically we're only here in Tractate Sota, out of the question of what do you say in Hebrew and what do you say in any language, I will say that it makes sense for the Tractate of Sota to be another moment where the rabbis in the Mishnah are trying to come along and spell out the full details for a ritual described in the Torah. There are not that many rituals that are described with this many steps and this sort of level of intricacy. The other would be Yom Kippur and all of the rituals of Yom Kippur. And in that way, the tractate, the Mishnah tractate on Yom Kippur and Sota kind of fall into this ritual narrative genre. Okay, thank you all for this time together. I hope we have a lot of strength for the rest of this day.
Thank you.